This shir begins the saga of understanding Yiftach, the Shofet Yiftach. This particular recording is not recorded live, owing to the fact that the recorder is not there during the actual shir. It is recorded for the benefit of those who are not able to be there and will be up online for availability. In general, there will be one source book for this particular unit of Yiftach, which will be available and uploaded to every upload or audio upload of the shirim as we go in the parts throughout. We're going to start on page 1, in the beginning of the source book, This begins our introduction to Yiftach, starts in the 10th perek of Shoftim. For the benefit of just seeing the larger picture, there are really going to be four sections that we're going to be dealing with Yiftach. The first section is going to be the sins of Bnei Israel on the search for a leader. That's the context into which he walks. Number two is going to be Yiftach's personal life story, which leads him to become the leader. That's going to be the beginning of Perek Yud Aleph. And then there's going to be the neder, the infamous or rather famous neder of Yiftach, which most people are familiar with. And finally, a lesser known part of his life is at the beginning of Perek Yud Beis, which discusses civil war. So those are the four sections that we're going to be walking through. The introduction to being a leader, the context, his life, his personal life and becoming that leader, the neder of Yiftach following the war, and finally, the civil war with the tribe of Ephraim that follows at the end of his days. And we'd like to see, as we go through it, to try to join these different parts to get a picture of the more holistic picture as a whole, trying to understand Yiftach as a whole. So we start off on page 1. This is Perek Yud Pasuk Vav. The context into which we begin this particular era is following directly the Shofet Yair. After Avimelech, the son of Gidon, was killed, then Yair steps to the plate and becomes the Shofet. After a number of years of leading the Jews, he dies, and the Jews revert back to their ways, as it seems to be in the cycle of Shoftim. Once the leader disappears, then the Jews revert back to their old ways and start sinning. But there's something unusual about this round. There's something unusual about the way the Jews deal with the Avodah Zorah in this particular section now. And it starts as follows. Vayasifu b'nei Yisrael la'asos hara b'nei Hashem. The Jews continued to do bad in the eyes of Hashem. Vayavdu esa ba'olim v'es ashtarois v'es elohei Aram v'es elohei Tzidon v'es elohei Mo'ab v'es elohei b'nei Amon v'es elohei Plishtim. And they served the Baal, the Ashtaros, the gods of Aram, the gods of Tzidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of B'nai Amon, the gods of the Plishtim. You took count, there's actually seven sets of Avodah Zorah there. Seven sets of Avodah Zorah which they're involved in, which is really quite a colossal amount. We haven't seen such an incredible amount of diversification in their polytheism. And finally, at the end of the Pasuk, Vayazvu es Hashem, and they left God, and they did not serve him. Very, very, it's a pretty terrifying point, pretty stark. The Jews are really seem to be serving, to a great degree, so many different deities. Something we haven't seen up till now. And also another point, which is also makes this even more dire, is the fact that it talks about leaving God. Because, as we pointed out before, as some of the Mefarshim understood, when it comes to Gidon, the Jews certainly were serving Baal. That was the particular god that they were serving at the time. But it is possible to argue that the Jews were serving Baal simply because Baal was the rain god. And the Jews, as agriculturalists, as farmers, needed rain. So you know what they did? They hedged. They tried to serve whoever would be beneficial for their crops. If it's God, Hashem, then they would serve him. And then if it was Baal, they'd serve him as well. So they'd serve a number of different in their worldview deities. Now that obviously doesn't work with monotheism, because monotheism by definition means to the exclusion of all other gods. But at least in their world picture, God existed. Perhaps they didn't understand him fully. Perhaps they didn't serve him fully. But over here we're seeing a picture which is being painted for us of really service of seven other deities to the exclusion of God, to the exclusion of Hashem. Now that's something scary. That's something we haven't seen up till now. A complete abandonment of Hashem. So what's the response? The response is, in Pasuk Zayin, Vayicharav Hashem b'Yisrael, Hashem got angry with Israel, Vayimkarem b'yad plishtim uv'yad b'nei Amon, and he sells them in the hands of the Philistines and the b'nei Amon, the children of Amon. fascinating point is that these are two nations of whom the Jews are serving their deities. Interesting point, just a historical point to think about, is the Jews try so much to become part of other societies. It's interesting that those very societies they try to become part of are the societies which oppress and kill them. Right? This is a particular paradigm which repeats itself in history. Are we going to become German in order that they should accept us? Does that lead to a result they're going to be inclusive? It seems not. And here we have it over here. The Jews serve many Avodah Zorahs, including the Avodah Zorah of the Philistines and the Bnei Ammon. And the response somehow is God selling them into the hands of two of those five nations. Fascinating. So now, what goes on? Vayiratzu vayiratzatzu. We're in Pasuk Ches. Vayiratzu vayiratzatzu es b'nei Yisrael. And the translation of the Mechon Mamre is they oppressed and crushed the Jews. These are very severe expressions. Vayabashana hahi, in that particular year, shmona esrei shana. It was 18 years. Es kol b'nei Yisrael sheber vayaden, all the Jews on Transjordan, Beretz Emori Asher Bagilad, in the land of the Amorites, which were in the land of Gilad. So we talk about the east bank of the Jordan. We talk about an oppression which either starts off very strong in the first year and carries on for 18 years, or maybe the last year was more oppressive than the first one. It's not clear. But nonetheless, we're talking about the Jews in Transjordan, the east bank of the Jordan over here, being oppressed by the Ammonites. And this is significant because if you'll just turn for a moment to the map on page, the map at the very end, there's two maps at the end of this of the booklet. The map on page 13, you will see that Ammon is to the right. Ammon is to the east, which is directly next to the land of Gilad and to the land of the tribes on the east side of the Jordan. Ammon is the top of the three nations which are live next to the Jews on the side of Israel there. There's Seir, or Edom, at the bottom, then Moab, and then Ammon. So Ammon's at the top over there, just to the right of the Jordan, between the Kinneret and the Dead Sea. So those are the oppressors coming from that side, and they actually they oppress the Jews right next to them in the land of Gilad. But it gets worse than that, because the Pasuk talks about in Pasuk Tes, Vayavru b'nei Ammon es Yarden, and the b'nei Ammon crossed the Jordan, Lilachem gam b'Yehuda v'Binyamin v'Beis Ephraim. And then they went across the Jordan to oppress now not just the Jews on Transjordan, but even in Israel proper, the Yehuda, Binyamin, and Beis Ephraim. Those are the southern tribes over there. Vateitzer yili Yisrael ma'od. And they created a great amount of strife or stress among the Jews over there. And we can see, if you go back to the map, you can see that they are directly across the Jordan from where Gilad is, and a little further south as well. So we have this terrible oppression as a response to their particular sins. Now, there is something unique about this, as we've seen, the fact that there's such a great pursuing of Avodah Zorah at this particular time, which is seemingly unprecedented. So the Gemara actually in Beitza, this can be found on page 6, the beginning of the sources. And page 6, it's the first source in the box. And this is quoting a Gemara in Beitza. The Gemara in Beitza says as follows, regarding this particular incident. In Aramaic, Turmusa mekatei raglehon desoneon shel Yisrael. The turmusa, which is a particular type of legume, it is a legume which has a number of different species. Actually, today it's being used as a soy supplement today, and there are many different types of species of this type of plant. It has flowers, but it also has an edible part. So this turmus, not to be confused with tiramisu in the dessert, this is actually a vegetable. This particular vegetable is going to cut down the feet of the haters of the Jews. Now, usually when the Gemara uses the expression Sonehon Shel Yisrael, the haters of the Jews, what it means to say is the Jews themselves, but it's a euphemism. It's talking about as if they're the enemies of the Jews. But in actuality, we, the reader, realize that the haters of the Jews are very Jews themselves, unfortunately. The Jews undermining their very position. So somehow this turmus, this particular fruit or vegetable, is going to be undermining the position of the Jews. Why so? Why does it prosecute against them? So the Gemara quotes our Pasuk. Shenei Amar, as we know in the Pasuk, it says in Shoftim and Perek Yod, Vayosifu b'nei Yisrael asos sara b'nei Hashem. The Jews continued doing evil in the eyes of Hashem. Vayavdu es ha-ba'alim ves ha-shtaros ves alahei Aron ves alahei Tzidon ves alahei Moab ves alahei b'nei Amon ves alahei Plishtim. Vayazu es Hashem v'lo yavaduhu. Now they served these seven deities and they left God and did not serve him. The Gemara asks a very simple question. Mimashma sh'ne'emar vayazu es Hashem. From the fact that the apostle tells us that they actually left God, and he yodeh sh'lo yavaduhu, is it not clear that they didn't serve him? If you're not arriving at the temple, if you're not at the Mishkan, if you're not involved in service of God, if you're abandoning him, obviously you're not serving him. Why does the pasuk stress both the positive and the negative of the statement that they left God and they didn't serve him? Why does the pasuk need to tell us that they didn't serve God? Omar Rebbe Elazar. Rebbe Elazar explains. Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God says, I feel a keturmus hazeh. Even like this turmus, this particular legume, sheshalkin osay sheva pa'amim v'oichlin osay b'kinuach suda, loy asouni bonai. This particular vegetable is unique in this sense. Now this turmus is something which has a number of acids which make it inedible. However, after 7 times of cooking it, or an intensive cooking process, it is edible. Hashem turns to the Jews and says, wait a second. I've cooked this vegetable can be cooked 7 times, but there's an outcome. There's something which is gained from the fact that it was cooked and underwent an intense process of refining. But you don't even treat me like that, the Jews. You, O Israel, don't even treat me like that. What are the 7 cookings the Jews have been through? What are the 7 pure processes of purification the Jews have been through up till now? It's fascinating. The Mefarshim point out that in fact Yiftach is actually the 8th of the Shoftim. There's been 7 Shoftim up till now, which is the significance of the number 7 over here, because a turmus can be cooked 7 times. It can undergo a refining process, but it comes out pure. It comes out edible. Interestingly, Hashem is turning to the Jews and saying, you've been through 7 processes of purification under Shoftim, but you don't seem to have changed. You've gone back. And not only have you gone back, you've gone back to 7 deities. After 7 processes of purification, you're back to serving 7 deities. That's the anger which Hashem's expressing at this particular time, why the Pasuk is stressing, not only did they leave Hashem and they didn't serve him, but there doesn't seem to be any improvement for the whole process up till now. That's the underlying critique over here which is veiled in our Pasuk. 7 Shoftim, yet they after 7 Shoftim, they serve 7 Avodah Zarahs. And that's not the last 7. So let's move on to now the response of this. So regularly, what we expect in Sefer Shoftim is that once the Jews serve Avodah Zarah, they leave Hashem to some degree, then they're sold in the hands of an oppressor. When they're sold in the hands of an oppressor, the Jews cry out, and what happens? Hashem sends a shofet to save them. We're also going to see a little bit of a difference in the pattern as it expresses itself in this particular cycle. Let's take a look. As we return, this is now back to page 1. We're in Pasuk Yud Aleph. I'm sorry, we're in Pasuk Yud. Now the Jews' response to their suffering. The Jews call out to God, saying, and in Shir, one of the ladies pointed out that El Hashem is the name Yud Kevavke. They're appealing to the Midas Harachmim. They're appealing to Hashem in Midas Harachmim. Yet they say, Chotanu Loch, we've sinned against you. We've left our God. Now over here is Elokeinu as in Din. We've left God who is the Midas Adin of judgment. And we served the Baalim, the particular Avodah Zarah of Baal. Right? Sounds like the Jews are now recognizing that they actually served Avodah Zarah, and they're asking God for atonement. Fascinating. Okay. But look at the response. The response is odd. The response is not the regular response that we see in Sefer Shoftim. Vayomer Hashem in Pasuk Yud Aleph, Vayomer Hashem al Bnei Yisrael, Hashem said to the Jews, or rather let's call it Israel not to be anachronistic, to the Bnei Yisrael, to the children of Israel, Haloi mi Mitzrayim umin Ha'emori umin Bnei Amon umin Plishtim. Surely from Egypt, the Amorites, the Bnei Amon, and the Philistines, with Sidonim, the Amalek uMaon, and from another 3 nations, Sidon, Amalek, and Maon, Lochatzu Eschem. They have put pressure on you. They have caused you to distress in previous years. Vatitzaku elai. And then you called out to me in those previous situations. Voshiyaschem miyadam. And I did save you from their hands in those days. Vata azav temozi. But nonetheless, you left me. Vata avdu elohim achirim. And you served other gods. Lochein lo yosif lohoshiyaschem. I'm not going to save you anymore. Lechu v'zaku el ha'elohim asher bachartem bom. Go call out to the gods who you chose now. Heimo yoshia lochem be'es tzaraschem. Let them save you now in your tzara, in your distress. Very dire message. A very terrifying message which Hashem is responding to them. But you'll notice as well that within the response of Hashem saying, I saved you from a number of nations, is again the number seven. So we have three sets of seven over here. We have the set of seven shoftim, which judged the nation of Israel, or particular parts of the nation of Israel, at least, up till now, and it did not seem to make a lasting impression. We have the seven deities to which the Jews are serving. And now when Hashem's responding to their tshuva process, What's the response? I saved you seven times, but it didn't make a difference. So this cycle over here is really undermining the position of the Jews, which links to the mashal, to that parable we saw in the Gemara in Beitzah, which describes the fact that the Jews are the loss of their validity of the position that they're in, because one has to ask now. Really, what was not valid about their tshuva? Was there something insincere about their tshuva that Hashem responds in such a manner, unlike the previous times they've called out to Hashem? Was there something really insincere? What was lacking in their tshuva that Hashem responds such? The most simple explanation is like the child who's knocked over three paintings off the mantelpiece. And within quick succession, and after the third one, they come to you and say, I'm sorry. And you say, oh, I know you're not sorry, because it was only 5 minutes ago that we had all this whole discussion before, and you knocked it off again. Meaning, as sincere as you may sound now, or present yourself as, in the words of Stephen Covey, I can't hear your voice. I can't hear your words because your actions are shouting too loud. Meaning, your track record is undermining your position. If you're going to be saying sorry, if you're apologizing for what you're doing, then why were you back at square one? Why after seven rounds are you back to first base? That's possibly why it is Hashem's responding in this way. However, there is a little tweak which the Malbim introduces over here, which is maybe another perspective on this. If you just reverse to Pasuk Yud, when the Jews are expressing their first apology, the words they use are Chatana Loch, we served to you, we sinned against you, and we left God and we served the Baalim. The word Vechi can also be a questioning word. The Malbim points out that maybe the Jews were actually self righteous, and they were saying, in a delusional manner, yes, but they were saying, Vechi Ozavnes Elokeinu, do we really leave God? V'na'avodes Abalim, did we really, was it so bad? We had you in mind, God. We weren't fully leaving you, which is delusional, as the Psukim have clearly described to us. But maybe there's a self-justification over there. There's a rationalization of their position, which leads to the severity of the response of God, saying, yes, now go speak to those Avodah Zorahs and let them save you. That's perhaps another perspective on this conversation going on over here, which justifies the severity of God's response within the worldview of the Malbim. Fantastic. And now, well, actually not so fantastic, but not fantastic for the Jews, but we move on over here now to round two. When the Jews hear this response, and clearly this is something which has been being displayed publicly, one of the ladies in Shir pointed out that actually one should think about this carefully, because obviously there must be a prophet who's conveying this publicly, but the prophet is not being recorded over here. The prophet, whoever it is not going to be, this Navi is not going to be the person who's going to be leading the Jewish people. He's clearly just giving the message over, and the Tanakh does not seem important l'doras for the generations to know who that particular person is. But clearly this is a public conversation. So what happens? The Jews respond to Hashem and say as follows. Vayomru b'nei Yisrael el Hashem. The Jews said to God, Chatanu, we have sinned. Asay ata lanu kechol atov beinecha. Do what is ever good in your eyes. Ach hatzileinu no hayom hazeh. But save us today. Please save us. So now, what's different about this response? What's changed in the Jews' response? So first of all, if you're in the Malbim, there's no rhetorical questions over here. So that's important. They're not claiming that they didn't sin. They did say they sinned. What's this claim? Asay ata kol atov beinecha. Do what's good for you. So part of it over here is part of what might be going on over here is actually a very fascinating thing, and that is that we say in Tachanun on a daily basis, even though in the month of Nisan now we are not saying it. But at the beginning of Tachanun, we say the pasuk, "Vayomer David al God, tsar li ma'od." David says to God, "It is very difficult for me." I should fall in the hands of God. Let me not fall in the hands of human beings. What's David asking for? When David says, I prefer to fall, Kirabim Rachamov, I left out that section of the Pasuk, let me fall in the hands of God, Kirabim Rachamov, that there's great mercy in the hands of God rather than in the hands of humanity. What David HaMelech is saying is that I know I'm guilty. I know that there's certain things I need to pay for and certain things I need to receive punishment for. But my request is let that punishment be in the hands of God, because God is merciful. When you give the punishment to be meted out in the hands of humans, human beings can spiral out of control. As we saw, the whole Egypt experience, according to a number of the Mefarshim, according to the Ramban specifically, was an experience which wasn't supposed to be as severe as it actually occurred. There was supposed to be a nation which would enslave the Jews, and that there would be gerim there, and that there would be avod, there would be slaves under that particular nation. But the degree or the severity with which Egypt performed that prophecy was much greater than what was expected, so to speak, in the prophecy itself. They overdid it. They overdid their command, if you understand it in that particular way. But the Egyptians took it too far. When you give things to humans, it goes too far. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. When you give somebody power to do something, it's not always going to be successful in the hands of man. It might go too far. Say the Jews, or the Bnei Yisrael to Hashem. We're returning to our pasuk in Pasuk Tesvav. You do what is good in your eyes. Meaning, we're guilty, we deserve punishment, but bring that punishment from your hands. Save us from those nations, because we don't want to be in the hands of other human beings meaning out that punishment. That is what the Jews are arguing or requesting from Hashem. This is a completely new approach. Because up to now, beforehand, they weren't talking about punishment. They were just talking about being saved. Here they're admitting guilt. They're saying that they know they need to pay for what they did. But please, let that payment be from a human, from a Hashem, as opposed to a human. That is the request which we see the Jews expressing to Hashem. And now, what is the response? What do they do? They don't just talk the talk. They walk the walk. And in Pasuk Tezov, Vayasirus Elohei Anechor Mikirbam, they removed the foreign gods from their midst. Vayavdu Es Hashem, and they actually served God. Vatiktsar Nafshoi Ba'amal Yisrael. And his soul was grieved for the misery of Israel. Whose soul? The soul, it sounds like the soul of God. Vatiktsar Nafshoi Ba'amal Yisrael. Hashem was grieved for the misery of Israel. So there's a number of fascinating things that we need to think about within this Pasuk. First thing is just to point out is that Hashem's response does not seem to be verbal, which is a fascinating point throughout the story. We're going to have to keep a check on this particular theme. The response of God is not explicit. Even in the following psukim, we're going to see, when we get to them, that the people have to find their way to God. They're going to have to find the way to Geula themselves. Which is fascinating, because after all, if Hashem agreed to save them, then it's funny, because God is not an active part of this geula, it sounds like. Hashem's, in a certain sense, taking the back seat of this geula. Even in the response over here, where it sounds like Hashem is distressed, so to speak, with the condition of the Jews, he's not speaking or acting on it right now, as will be evident from the next few psukim. That's point number one. Point number two is this is a classic example of, and this is the big, a big pretentious word of the day, is this is an expression of anthropopathism. Now, we are perhaps familiar with the word anthropomorphism. Anthropomorphism is actually is the attribution of a human body part to something beyond the human, which we in our particular example is the divine. But anthropopathism is more than that. Anthropopathism is attributing divine human emotion to the divine. So how do we deal with that? This is just methodologically. This is a point which should make us stop and think how we deal with this in the rest of Tanakh. What is going on over here when it says Vatikzar Nafshay Ba'amal Yisrael, that Hashem is, so to speak, grieved or it somehow seems to hurt him, the state of the Jews, Ba'amal Yisrael, and the state of the Jews at this point in time. What does that mean? What is it trying to tell us? How do we deal with divine emotion being told to us in Tanakh? So, well, the first stop that we should really think about is the Rambam. In one of the 13 Ikarim of Emunah, one of the 13 foundations of the belief of Judaism, the Rambam delineates that one cannot believe that God is any form of body, any corporeality. God is far beyond anything physical, anything human. And, says the Rambam, if you were to believe that God had any form, that God was in some form, it was limited by the human condition, then you lose your share in the world to come. It is such an essential and underlying principle of Judaism that God is beyond the physical, that yes, you would lose your share to the world to come for not believing that. Now, a number of the Mepharshim actually turn that down. They say, yes, that's certainly a belief, but to the degree that you lose your world to come is very severe. But one should realize the Rambam is speaking to people at a time when, yes, there was a very firm belief that we can describe God in human terms. We look up at God, and God, you know, much like within Greek philosophy, is just really a very powerful being with all kinds of fallacies and problems, just like humans. And so, yes, the Rambam needed to underscore very, very strongly this point, that yes, there is no corporality, there is no material, there is no humanity which we attribute to God. Anything which is human is limited. God is beyond limitation. The Rambam had underlined that very clearly. However, it's important just to introduce another perspective over here, which is relevant for our particular story, especially in the depths of this story, where the Jews seem to be faring so badly. If you'd care to take a look in the sources on page 7, I put in a quote from Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. Rav Hirsch is commenting on Bereishis, Perek Vov, Pasuk Vov, in which we see another interesting anthropopathism. At the beginning of the flood, just before Hashem even commands Noach to make the ark, Hashem, it says that Hashem saw the evil of man, Vayinochem, and he, so to speak, changed his mind on having humanity around. Vayis'atzev el liboy. And he became saddened in his heart. So the two very unusual phrases over there. First of all, the notion that God changes his mind is point number one to take note of. And point number two to take notice of is that God is saddened in his heart. What's fascinating is, just as a parenthetical point, is that actually there is another similar anthropopathism at the very end of the flood. When Noach comes out of the ark and sacrifices a number of offerings to Hashem, it says that Vayarach Hashem es reach enichoach, that God smelled the pleasant odor of the sacrifices. That God smelt the sacrifices. Again, that is a anthropomorphism, right? So God is smelling. And then, Vayomer el liboy, and he said to his heart, Lo Yosef, that Hashem says, I'm not going to, in the future, ever destroy mankind again. Which is, by the way, that's the bookend of the flood story. It starts off with God being saddened in his heart, so to speak, and it ends off with Hashem speaking to his heart, saying, I'll never destroy man again. Those are the bookends, something very fascinating to understand why it is framed within anthropopathisms, these expressions of divine emotion. So Rav Hirsch has a very fascinating thing to say over here in trying to explain this unique expression of divine emotion. And I read as follows. Regarding this and similar anthropomorphic expressions of God. So he's lumping the two terms together. That any other similar terms describing God in human terms, we would like to make a general remark. For so long, people have philosophized all around these expressions to remove the danger of the slightest thought of any materiality or corporality of God, that at the end, one runs very nearly into the danger of losing all idea of the personality of God. Had that been the purpose of the Torah, those kind of expressions could easily have been avoided. What Rav Hirsch is saying is that, let's say it is so dangerous, it is so dangerous to think of God in any material form. It is so dangerous, the Rambam says, it would say, that one loses one's share in the Olam Haba for thinking such. Then why exactly did the Torah frame certain things as divine emotion? Why was that a necessary part of the Torah? The Torah could have just left it out. That would be it. Rav Hirsch continues. But this last danger is greater than the first. The two anthropomorphic expressions here save the two essential conceptions, the freedom, the free will of God, and that of man. Not for nothing does it say, when God saw, the wickedness of man was not a matter of necessity. God had to see it before he knew it. This expression gives us the guarantee of human free will. That's number one. Number one is that it is not just that it happened. Okay, creation has reached stage 3b, so we're going to move on to the next stage. That's also what's going on. The Torah tells us that God had to experience and see, so to speak, choosing to see, oh, look, man decided to take option B. Man is acting in an evil way. And therefore, we need to go on to the next stage. It's not a given. There's free will. It didn't need to be this way. That's point number one. There needs to be a response. There needs to be some vayinochem. There has to be the fact that God has to change his mind, so to speak. Why? Because it could have been otherwise. This expression guarantees that we had the free will to choose otherwise. Continuing in Rav Hirsch. And the fate that overtook mankind was not the result of physical causes which followed a set of laws. It was preceded by an examination by God and his decision. The decision itself pained the decider. All this presupposes the personality and free will of God and keeps this clear in our minds. Says Rav Hirsch, number one, these expressions, that the fact that God needed to change his mind, so to speak, shows us that there is the free will of man. That man, at least within our perspective, has the ability to be able to choose that. And number two is that it pains the decider. The way Rav Hirsch is understanding this is that it is talking about the pain of God, because it's like that father who has to say to his son, no, we're not going to go on the family vacation because of your behavior now. He has to do something which is right, but painful. That pains the father. So we're being shown the divine emotion, because there is this relationship there. It's not a cold system in which you press this button and such follows. There's a relationship. And the Torah is trying to express that in the form of divine emotion, to understand that there is this relationship. It isn't something which, so to speak, is easy for God. God is pained by the fact that he has to punish us. And he continues, the Rivet already, one of the most Jewish of our thinkers, is of the opinion that such consciousness of the personality of God is of much greater importance than speculating about it, as to whether this or that can be asserted of God. He quotes the Rivet at the end, who actually disagrees with the Rambam in terms of the severity of not believing that God has a body, or believing that God has a body. And he's bringing the Rivet over here to temper the position of the Rambam. That's the end of Rav Hirsch. What this does for us is, as we return to our story about Yiftach, and actually we have not met Yiftach yet, but the Jews calling out to God, when it says in our pasuk, "Vatikzar nafsha ba'amal Yisrael," that God was distressed in his soul, so to speak, about the pain of the Jews. This is there to show us that despite the depth of our depravity, despite the fact that after seven shoftim we have not learned, despite the fact that we're serving seven deities and we may even be self-justifying as the Malbim understands it, nevertheless, when we finally may reach the realization that we've sinned, when we reach that, then, so to speak, it's the pain that we are undergoing is, so to speak, unbearable. We're introduced to the fact that it hurts Hashem, so to speak. Not that Hashem needed to feel the hurt. Hashem chose to feel that pain, and therefore, that underlies the response which we're about to see over here in the coming shirim of where Yiftach fits in. That this is not just a cold relationship. Hashem is part of this, and the fact that the Jews are sinning, the fact that the Jews are the depth over here, is something which is really, really, really distressing, which causes Hashem to choose to want to express distress over here, and within this terrible goddess. So that's what we're going to hold today. Tomorrow we're going to finish the end of Perek Yud, and then actually finally meet Yiftach in the coming Shirim. Thank you, everybody, very much. Have a wonderful day.